This is the In Self-Defense Podcast with Don West and Sean Vinson, exploring high-profile self-defense cases and identifying the lessons learned for concealed carriers. Well, hey there, Don. How's it going?
Hey, Sean. Nice talking with you again.
Yeah, so you found yourself in California today, I hear.
I've been on the road quite a bit. I am on Pacific Coast time as we speak.
All right.
I'm trying to figure out which is my favorite time zone. I guess that comes from too much idle time, perhaps.
But do you have a leaning one way or the other so far?
Well, I have to admit I'm somewhat partial to the central time zone. And part of that is because you're not but an hour behind the East Coast, where things seem to start first in the day. And this is going to sound very superficial. The TV shows come on an hour earlier, so I can actually stay up late enough to watch some of the late night shows.
I like that. That's funny. See, now I live on the East Coast and I do a lot of business with law firms in the central time zone. So I love that I can get up late, see my kids off to school, and then my clients don't get to work at 9. So if I start working at 10 o'clock, I'm on time. So I that's working out for me right now at this point in my life.
Well, as they say, whatever works.
Sure.
And
you're in California, you have a lot of the day left ahead of you, and I'm here East Coast, and I'm looking forward to a ribeye in about an hour and a half. So.
Well, I won't be too long behind you. You know, at my age, we start eating a little earlier in the day.
Oh, the early bird's coming up. I got hopefully a few years before I get the early bird. Well, I'm glad we're together again talking. You know, we, in this series, in self-defense, we covered 9 high-profile cases. We looked at them for 4 elements that we saw were common in each one. There are some other similarities these cases had, with the exception of two cases, the shooters that we looked at ended up being convicted of some crime and spent time in jail. One of them plead out and spent some time in jail, and the other one was the only CCW safe member that we profiled, Stephen Maddox, and you worked on his defense and got him an acquittal with just a little over 2 hours of jury deliberation, if I recall correctly.
That's right. That's all the time the jury needed to reach the right result, although it was a 21-month ordeal for Stephen Maddox, and it was a 2-week trial. While the verdict was only 2 hours, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars spent in Stephen Maddox's defense for all the right reasons with the absolute right result.
So. Yeah, exactly. Well, and with that one, we'll call it a success story because in the end, the jury saw it the way they should have seen it. And Stephen's now rebuilding his life, even though that he suffered greatly and there was the tragedy of the shooting itself and the attack that he endured that led to that. But besides that case, where besides a few mistakes that Stephen made in dealing with law enforcement, you have a shooter who did practically everything right. On a lot of the other cases, there is a whole lot of what they did wrong. And yeah, our listeners, we've gotten some great feedback from folks who have listened to the podcast and read the articles that I've written online, and they say this is great, but you know, we'd love to hear a little more about what goes right. You've shown us the wrong way to do this. What's the right way to do this? And in that vein, and talking about the central time zone out in Oklahoma, we came across this case relatively recently, not long ago, of Zach Peters, who's a 22-year-old young man, lived at home with his parents. He was home alone during the middle of the day. I think he had been taking a nap, and he heard people break into his house. It turned out there were 3 teenagers who'd come in. They're armed with a knife and some brass knuckles. He wouldn't have known that or what they were armed with or how dangerous they were when he encountered them. He had grabbed a armed AR-15 that they had legally in their house. He fired. When he called 911 shortly thereafter, he told dispatchers he thought he had hit two of them. What he didn't know is he had actually hit all three. Two of them fell to the floor in the kitchen of the home. One of them made it outside and eventually died on his driveway. A fourth accomplice, a getaway driver, was out and she sped off. Then Zach, after firing and neutralizing the threat, then went down the hall, barricaded himself inside a bedroom, locked the door, kept the gun out, called 911, and had about a 5-minute conversation with dispatchers until police arrived and secured the scene.
In addition to the facts that you've outlined, the weapons that the intruders had, they were also dressed as you might think intruders or burglars or home invaders would be dressed. I don't recall if they were wearing all black, which is somewhat cliche, but they were masked. They had made a clear effort to prepare themselves for this. This wasn't a spur of the moment, let's go through a window and steal the beer from the fridge.
Sure. In fact, they had been to that address and had successfully broken into the guest house, from what I read, and decided that that went well. They'd come back and hit the main house. So it was definitely a planned and conceived burglary.
Not only just that, but also with the anticipation that there may be a confrontation of some sort, since they were armed.
Sure, we've looked at cases like the Byron Smith case, where two teenagers broke in. They were unarmed. It clearly did not expect anyone to be home. These teens at least anticipated the possibility of it. Mm-hmm. And were ready to fight if they needed to.
Sure.
But they never got that chance in this case.
As I recall, some of the gunfire was heard by a neighbor. Didn't quite know what was going on. The police responded immediately. Zach Peters did exactly the right thing by calling 911 immediately. He did the best kind of assessment he could of the aftermath and then was fully cooperative with the police. I don't know to what extent he cooperated and with or without counsel, but I think that this was a very straightforward, pretty easy process. Because he was in his own home, there were these obvious intruders, and that, in fact, under Oklahoma law, while everyone who is in a self-defense situation needs to reasonably fear an imminent attack sufficient to cause great bodily harm or death, when you're in your home, you're in a special situation. And most jurisdictions, frankly, and Oklahoma is one of them, that if you are defending your home against an intruder, the law presumes that you have a reasonable fear of imminent peril or death or great bodily harm. So obviously this is exactly the situation where law enforcement would give Zach Peters the benefit of the doubt in their investigation, unless they revealed other information that really caused them to question what seemed to be a very straightforward yet tragic situation.
Yeah, and so I think there's two issues that your comments made me think about in this case. And I think both of them are probably a little bit of a stretch, because this is such a clear-cut case of self-defense where armed intruders broke into somebody's house in a state where Oklahoma's self-defense law is sometimes referred to as the Make My Day law. It's one of the most shooter-friendly or self-defense-friendly laws that we have in the country. But despite that, you know, when I was researching this case, I found a few voices who were critical and suggested that perhaps the use of force came too early, maybe before he was really able to determine if these intruders constituted an immediate threat to his life or to his life and limb to him before he fired. Now, I tend to be pretty conservative when we look at these cases, but in this case, I have trouble with these, you know, fringe voices who say maybe he should have waited longer. That's possible, but I don't think we'd ever hold somebody to that standard when armed people dressed like intruders have broken into your house.
I don't know if the focus of those comments, whether they were an attempt to sincerely understand what happened and look for a way that the intruders could be neutralized without the loss of life, whether that was the angle or whether they somehow just condemned what Zach Peters did in general and used the idea, well, they really, he should have waited longer, or I don't know how much longer he could have waited or should have waited. Tactically or from a defensive standpoint, legally, what I referred to earlier is this notion that if somebody breaks into your house, while in most every other self-defense situation, you would in fact have to face the reality of an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death, and it would not be presumed simply because you were involved in a self-defense situation that your fear of that was reasonable. It changes a little bit in the house.
Yeah, understandably so.
Everything,
so.
The law favored Zach Peters in this situation, and it probably doesn't take as much as what happened legally in this case for the intruders to come inside, to be armed, to be clearly dressed like that, for the presumption to kick in.
Sure. So. And you'd mentioned a minute ago that maybe the people who would have any criticism of this case were thinking about the second issue that I wanted to bring up here, and that's the fact that he used an AR-15 for home defense. I read at least one opinion piece on there that was written after the shooting down in South Florida at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School, which was an yes. AR-15, mm-hmm. that kind of said, isn't this enough? Do we need AR-15 for home defense? And that's a whole conversation on its own about how easily accessible AR-15 should be. But the fact is that it's legal. This family owned one legally. And I think when it comes to what you use to defend your home, it's whatever gets the job done. And in this case, it happened to be an AR-15. But I think some of the criticism comes from the weapon. I'm curious, Don, if you, in all the self-defense cases that you've tried, does the weapon come into play when investigators or a jury might look at a shooting?
I think it certainly can come into play. You're talking about this particular style of weapon.
Sure, sure. Some people will want to call it an assault rifle.
Mm-hmm. The choice of weapon is very personal, of course, and it largely depends on how you feel that you may wind up using it. It's certainly not exceptional at all for someone to have a long rifle at their home, something that they're comfortable shooting. I guess that's probably a big part of it, is what are you comfortable with? What can you manage effectively? What are you accurate with? Maybe even what other family members are able to comfortably use. And from that perspective, I'm certainly no expert whatsoever, but I understand that that type of weapon, the AR-15, is particularly easy to use for a wide variety of shooters,
sure.
Relatively young, relatively old. The recoil is considerably less than other kinds of weapons you might typically think people would have, you know, double barrel shotguns.
Sure. I fired it on the range, and it's a nice rifle to fire. You know, go ahead.
I wanted to comment too, and that's a discussion that people should have with each other and probably before they weigh in on whether they're in favor or against that type of weapon, they should go fire one. They should talk to people about it. They should make an informed decision whether it's the kind of weapon that would be appropriate for them and how they anticipate that they could be in a defensive situation. The comment you made, though, about how choice of weapons can come into play, I think more likely in a self-defense case when you typically are dealing with a handgun is people that do custom modifications that use stickers or logos or maybe even out there on social media bragging about the number of guns or the kinds of guns they have, something that might make it seem like they are looking for someone to give them an excuse to use it kind of thing, or they consider themselves a particularly badass kind of person and they like to display that sort of stuff. Well, the prosecutor is going to pay very close attention to how you present at the time of the incident, but also how you presented in the past, whether it's through social media or even at work, or family members can be questioned by law enforcement, just to get a true understanding of what was likely going on in your head when this thing happened. So, yes, I think choice of weapon modifications and just simply how you conduct yourself generally, especially when you're armed, will come into play.
Fair enough. And I think this case made national headlines. I don't think there's ever really any question in law enforcement about clearing Zach for the shooting, but I don't think it makes national headlines if he hadn't used an AR-15, just because of the controversy around that gun.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair comment, and I suspect that that's not the sort of thing that would have given law enforcement a great deal of concern or the district attorney a great deal of concern.
Sure, but public opinion it can be affected.
Well, I listened to the 911 call. He certainly conducted himself appropriately. He seemed to have the appropriate affect, although it was a very traumatic situation. He kept it reasonably well together. There is an aspect of this case, though, that is still ongoing in that there was a fourth member of this group, and that was the female driver of the getaway car. This case is still in the news because she is facing, I guess it's 3 counts of felony murder.
That's right.
Even though, by all accounts, she never left the car, and
that's fair enough.
My goodness. What she was really doing is just staying in the car and was going to drive away once they came out with whatever they had stolen.
Yeah, it's also suspected that she was the architect of the whole robbery, too, or the burglary.
Because of her prior familiarity with the
place?
Yeah,
they thought it was her that put the other ones up to it. But fascinating. We talked about that a little bit in the other case out of Oklahoma, the pharmacist who he shot one of the robbers, and it was the robber's accomplice who, in addition to Ursland, the pharmacist, going to jail, the accomplice was convicted for murder as well.
Just as a quick aside, of course, she wasn't in the house. She didn't have a gun or other weapons. She didn't participate directly in the burglary other than, or robbery, characterizing it as a burglary, maybe with the expectation that if there's a confrontation, there would be weapons used. That sort of makes it look like a home invasion robbery, although maybe in their minds it was just...
They meant for it to be a burglary, sure.
But under a great number of states' jurisdictions, if there is a death that occurs during the commission of a qualified felony, and certainly burglary would, as would home invasion robbery, any other participant can be legally accountable for murder. And it doesn't even have to be a first-degree murder In fact, it can be in a lot of places, even an accidental murder, an accidental homicide that occurs during the commission of one of these. And the living participants can be on the hook. And I think there's a high probability this young woman will receive a lengthy prison sentence.
Yeah, that's all fascinating stuff. Well, this was an interesting case. We have some other interesting cases to talk about. I'd love to take a quick break and then join you again for a little more conversation.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Sean.
This is Sean. I'm back with Don West, National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe, veteran criminal defense attorney. You know, Don, it was occurring to me earlier today that it was about this time of the year in 2012 that I met you for the first time.
Yes. My goodness. Time has flown, hasn't it?
It seems like a long time ago.
It sure does.
My kids were tinier, that's for sure. And we've had some adventures since then.
We have. We've traveled the world a bit together, spoken a number of times, both on record with some of the programs that we're putting together with CCW Safe, and also enjoyed each other's company from time to time, just as life unfolds.
As life unfolds. And then... It might happen to see each other in court inside the next 45 days, if fate allows.
Yes, I hope that case that we're connected with, that we're sort of being somewhat vague about on purpose, will be an opportunity for us to do another deep dive in some truly fascinating aspects of self-defense law and
maybe how... hurriedly eat some really unhealthy hamburgers.
That as well. I'm looking forward to that case. I won't spend any more time sort of with the teaser on it, but it has almost everything you get, including what might be called political motivations behind it. And
it's super crazy. But since we can't talk about that case, let's talk about a case out of Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio. I saw this case not long ago when I was doing some research, and I flagged it immediately because it addresses one of these key issues that we talk about a lot. And that is, and we'll get into the nuance of this, and you can explain that. This isn't strictly stand your ground, but we've got a case here where the self-defense homicide occurs when Ohio is a squarely duty to retreat, not a stand your ground state at all. And although there is surveillance video that makes it seem pretty clearly self-defense, prosecutors charge it as murder. And then on the day that trial's set to begin, the judge indicates that he's going to hold the prosecution to this new standard in the law, which would be going into effect that Thursday of trial, 4 days after trial started, essentially shifting the burden from the defense to prove that it was self-defense to the prosecutors to prove that it was self-defense. And I want you to, I may have said that a little bit wrong, I want you to clarify, but real quick, let me just give the setup to this this homicide.
Yes,
we're in a kind of a seedy bar in a rough part of Cleveland. There's a guy, Joshua Walker, who's at the bar minding his business. Really, there's a guy named Aaron down the way who the two have had some bad blood, but he's minding his business. But then you see in the security video, he just gets up, walks over to Joshua. Joshua stands up in response to what was probably some tough talk. And then this guy, Aaron, just starts wailing on him. It's just punching him in the face. And it takes only seconds for the two of them to fight their way out the front door. there's a security camera out there. We switch to that view, and then all of a sudden you see Joshua Walker on the ground. There's other guys on top of him, and then Walker has his gun out. He fires a shot. The other guy is down, and Walker gets up and he flees. And when I say flees, he flees all the way from Cleveland, Ohio, to Phoenix, Arizona, on the run. So obviously makes a critical mistake there in not reporting this. He's arrested in Phoenix, charged with murder and this homicide. And then we get the trial and they drop charges. But tell me about this change in Ohio law that happened that changed the calculus in this case.
You know, you say that, change the facts of the case. Let me just...
change the calculus of the case. The
yeah, facts let me the let same. Me key off of that, because this is one of those cases that the facts are hardly in dispute at all. Some of the interpretation might be, but as you said before, virtually all of the critical moments are on video, and no one can dispute that Joshua Walker was attacked in the bar, that there was a physical struggle when outside, and that the fellow that attacked him had the better of him, and Joshua Walker was on the ground trying to fight from the ground as this other man, Aaron
sure,
Mason,
the prosecutor even admits
was on top of him. Yeah,
the prosecutor
yeah,
admits so, that Walker's on the ground, the guy's on top of him when he shoots. Sounds like another case you know of.
You know, there are so many parallels factually as this thing plays out, frankly, between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. The idea that there was a blow struck, there was a fight, and that one person in the Zimmerman case, Zimmerman, no one can really dispute that with all the physical evidence and eyewitness evidence, that he was on the ground while he was being struck by Trayvon Martin, and there was an eyewitness to that, and the forensic evidence demonstrated that the shot was fired from basically the same position that Joshua Walker was in.
On the ground with someone on top of you.
Yeah, so we have a case that factually is pretty clear, and as you mentioned, the prosecutor doesn't really dispute that scenario and acknowledges that Joshua Walker was defending himself from the physical attack. What made this so fascinating, though, is that up until recently, Ohio was an outlier on self-defense cases, self-defense law. In fact, such an outlier that it was the only state in the country. All other 49 states required the prosecution to disprove self-defense in making a case, and Ohio had a completely different structure. In Ohio, you had to prove that you weren't at fault, that you were defending yourself, and you had the burden of persuasion. And the prosecutor could basically sit back and convince the jury that you didn't carry the weight of the evidence and you'd wind up being convicted. What happened is the law changed and Ohio now has a much more traditional approach to prosecutions of homicides where there's a self-defense claim. And as I said, now, and what exactly happened on the eve of Joshua Walker's trial, was that the law was passed by the state legislature. The prosecution then had the burden of persuasion. They had the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt to show that the shooting was not in self-defense. So on one day, Joshua Walker has to prove that he's innocent, effectively. The next day, the prosecutor, as the judge ruled he would apply the new law, had to convince the jury that it wasn't self-defense. And that in and of itself was enough to convince the prosecutor to reevaluate the case. And frankly, I thought the prosecutor was pretty candid. He was on camera being interviewed and he said, I don't think we can do it. I think the new law is a game changer. And when we look at the factual scenario, the undisputed facts, that he's not satisfied to his ethical and legal responsibility as a prosecutor that he could prove the case. So they dropped it.
Yeah, you know, here's what burns me up about this case is that prosecutor tells that reporter, looks into the camera, and says, not only that it's because the law changed, but if you look at the video, it's just clearly self-defense. Well, they had that video throughout the whole prosecution. The law, to your point, didn't change the facts. The facts aren't in dispute. And as somebody who's hitched his wagon to the criminal defense side of these matters, it drives me nuts that that same prosecutor all of a sudden would have felt fine yesterday trying this case, but today suddenly has an ethical realization that it's not murder, it's self-defense. I mean, you've encountered that mindset, haven't you, Don, as a defense attorney?
Oh, I think so. Sometimes I wonder how prosecutors can convince themselves that they can still go forward in good faith when they take a cold, hard look at the facts and still go forward. And this fellow, though, doesn't seem to be politically driven in any way. I never got the sense that this was somehow a big deal case. I wonder if Joshua Walker wasn't his own worst enemy in some ways by virtue of him fleeing.
Yeah, that's
for sure. We now know probably why he did, and that's an interesting aspect of this case too. It turns out that he was on federal probation for some offense and a convicted felon, so it made it
And not allowed illegal. To have the gun that he used.
Absolutely not. He was a felon in possession, which carries a pretty significant federal prison sentence. And I suppose he may have known he's just likely to go to prison for possessing the gun, even if he did act in self-defense, just for the circumstance. And the fact, I guess the last report I read was he is in jail being prosecuted.
Yeah, he's still on the hook for that crime, yeah.
So here's an interesting spin on that, too. He was allowed to present self-defense and would have gone to trial under the old law on self-defense, and he may have won, he may not have. I think it's clear he should have. But now with the new law change, the prosecutor didn't think he had the goods to go forward and dismiss the case, but it wasn't on any basis other than that the law wouldn't sustain a conviction. What's trailing all of that, which I thought was pretty interesting, is that even though Joshua Walker illegally possessed the firearm, he was still allowed to present a self-defense case.
Sure.
So it wasn't as if he were legally precluded from defending himself. He was going to get the benefit of the law of self-defense in Ohio, whether it was the old law or the new law, but of course he was also committing another crime at that very moment that self-defense does not protect him from. That was the illegal possession of the weapon. One other comment on the law change. Not to be confused that the new law included stand your ground or make my day type provisions. There was a companion provision that would have established in Ohio a stand your ground type approach to self-defense.
Sure, they didn't waive that duty to retreat.
That's
that stays in the law.
The stand your ground aspect of the statute would have eliminated the duty to retreat. That was not passed. So Ohio remains a duty to retreat. What it did was it changed the rules in court.
Yeah.
And but factually, Joshua Walker had no safe means of retreat anyway. He was on his back being pummeled out in the parking lot.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, because I've had arguments with intelligent people that stand your ground really refers only to duty to retreat or not, and that the laws, that some of the parts of the statute that regard where the burden of proof is or how a case will be tried or whether there's any prosecutorial immunity are separate from duty to retreat. It all gets wrapped up into this idea of stand your ground, but there's actually some nuanced differences in law. I'm going to point to this case next time I have that argument to show that here's a case where duty to retreat's not waived, but just the standard of proof is different, and that's enough to turn a prosecution into a no true bill.
Yes, that's right. And there's a parallel between this case factually that we touched on with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. Florida's Stand Your Ground did not put George Zimmerman in a position where he had the legal requirement to retreat. Nonetheless, the facts demonstrated that he had no safe means of escape. He was on his back on the ground. So whether he had the duty to retreat or not didn't matter. He couldn't retreat. So therefore, contrary to a great number of news reports and heated debates in the media, George Zimmerman was never a stand your ground case because he was never in a position where he had the choice to flee or fight. And Joshua Walker, while he did have a legal duty retreat, was physically unable. So had stand your ground been the law of Ohio, that wouldn't have changed the legal principles anyway in this case because of the facts.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, hey, since you're talking about Florida law, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about a Florida case that's had some updates since the last time we talked about it.
Good. Looking forward to it.
All right. We'll be right back, guys. This is Sean Vincent. I'm back with Don West. Don, we're going back to Florida in our minds to a case that we've talked about a little bit before. This was from July of last year. It's the Michael Draker case. And if you remember
that's
this,
right. That's the one everybody calls the handicap parking spot case.
Yeah, the parking spot shooter. So what happens is Michael Drake is at this convenience store. A guy named Marquise McLaughlin pulls up, his girlfriend and their son are in the car. The girlfriend stays in the car. The son comes in with McLaughlin. While they're inside the store, Drake goes up to the girlfriend and starts criticizing her for parking in this handicapped parking spot. He's getting a little aggressive with her. McLaughlin comes out and sees this dude giving static to his girl in the car, and he walks up to him pretty quickly, and this is all on video. We don't hear sound, but we see the video. He pushes him for a push relatively violent to the ground. So Draka hits the ground, he sits up a little bit, he pulls out a pistol from his, that he has carrying with him in his waist, and he shoots him. He shoots McLaughlin, who is there, and I remember watching this video and talking with you about it later. It looked to me like McLaughlin was posturing and showing his dominance over this guy. He just put to the ground, but as soon as he sees that pistol, he starts to turn away, and that's when he gets shot. And at first, Draco wasn't charged. He claimed self-defense. They saw the video. They say under the law, we can't do it. But since we talked about it, he has been charged with murder or manslaughter, I think, actually.
Manslaughter is the formal charge.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And new facts have come out. We looked at those, and these are kind of facts that I refer to as prior bad acts.
The sequence is exactly as you described it. The initial decision by the sheriff's office was not to make an arrest, and they cited Florida's Stand Your Ground law, meaning basically the statute that requires law enforcement to have probable cause in a claim of self-defense case before they can make an arrest. And the sheriff publicly said he didn't have that based upon the scenario. Pretty quickly after the case was referred to the state attorney's office, a decision to charge manslaughter was made, and Draco was arrested. And then more investigation was done, not just of the case itself that's depicted in the video, but also it included, no doubt, any other witness, and then digging a little deeper into the prior history of Michael Draco with law enforcement and beyond, even involving incidents where no law enforcement was contacted and no arrests were made. And the subject of prior bad acts becomes our conversation today in large part because under Florida law and the evidence code, there is a way that prior incidents of crimes or wrongs or certain acts that are not directly related to the facts of the charge can be offered by the prosecution, and frankly, in rare circumstances, even offered by the defense, in evidence for the jury to consider on certain aspects of the elements of the case. So that's sort of the backdrop of where we are now, since additional investigation has now revealed, what is it, two or three specific discrete instances where they're alleging that Draco, you know, was misbehaving.
Yeah, let me ask a couple questions to clarify that. I think in Florida they call that Williams rule, right?
They call it colloquial. Is that word colloquially? It's called Williams rule because the significant case in Florida was Williams, and that established the clear rule providing notice and that you have the right to litigate prior to the admission of the evidence and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So lawyers will call it Williams rule. It's, I think, 90.404.
Yeah, and most states have some version of that. And the idea is that when you're on trial for a crime, you're on trial for that crime, and that things that you've done beforehand, unless they meet this threshold, that they're specifically relevant or similar enough to the new act, shouldn't be let in unless you can pass that threshold, right?
Yes, that's right. People shouldn't be judged based upon being generally a bad person or have bad character traits or in some way allowing the jury to dislike someone because of something they did in the past that was unrelated and use that as evidence to convict them of something.
Right, right.
It's unfair.
Right, you can be guilty of being an asshole. That doesn't make you guilty of murder in this case, right? That's the idea.
And in fact, you may be guilty of a car theft in the past that wouldn't necessarily make you guilty of bank fraud in the future.
Sure. And, you know, two of the cases in our series that we looked at had some elements of these prior bad acts. And one was Gerald Strebent, who shot David Crowfoot in Oregon after a collision on a dark highway at night, and Crowfoot came at Strebent. He told him, get away. He had a rifle in his hand. He's a trained Marine sniper. He was a former MMA fighter, but he ended up shooting Crowfoot after Crowfoot had touched his gun. And that seems cut and dry, but just a week before, Strebent had put stuff on his Facebook page about how he was going to strike hard and fast like a cobra for anyone who drives too slow. He had a history of brake checking people. He had demonstrated on social media a pretty flippant attitude about violence, and he had been involved. Well, he was a witness in a murder trial, and he'd been involved in other stuff. I mean, the attorney Mike Arnold called this the parade of horribles. And when he wasn't sure if he was going to get that stuff excluded in trial, that's when they ended up pleading that case out.
Well, of course, the fundamental of a self-defense case, the fundamentals are that you go into a self-defense case admitting that if it's a lethal self-defense case, you admit that you used deadly force against someone and that it resulted in their serious injury or death. A lethal self-defense case means death. You shot and killed somebody, and that's murder or some degree of criminal homicide unless you have a legal excuse. The legal excuse of self-defense, and by excuse, I don't mean something you just make up like you're trying to make up an excuse. The legal excuse
meaning,
justification is that if you reasonably believed that you were facing an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death, essentially you had no choice but to use lethal force to save your own life
the him or me moment.
Right then and there, then you're not guilty. That's the claim of self-defense. But implicit within that is the reasonableness of your conduct, the purity of your thoughts. Were you using force because you believed you were about to be injured or killed, or were you angry, or were you seeking revenge for some prior incident? All of that stuff has to be sorted out by the trier of fact or the jury. And when you're, anytime you're trying to figure out what's going on in someone's mind, you typically, it's a circumstantial inspection rather than direct. And all sorts of things will reflect and provide some insight into that thinking.
But these prior bad acts can speak to what that mindset was and undermine the idea that they were simply just in fear and didn't have anything to do to start the confrontation that happened. Or the other case that we looked at where this happened was Ronald Gasser out of New Orleans. And why I think that one's particularly relevant to our conversation today is he essentially had a road rage incident with Joe McKnight that ended at this intersection. McKnight got out of his car, approached Gasser's car, Gasser shot him, and was subsequently arrested. He lost his case. He's been convicted of murder. But a year before that, or at some time before that, he had been in a fight, a road rage fight, at that very same intersection. And his lawyers fought hard to keep that out, but it was so, seemed parallel to his confrontation with McKnight that that was presented at trial. Big problem for him at trial.
Well, of course, as hard as his lawyers fought to keep it out, the prosecutor would fight to get it in to evidence because everyone knew that prior incident was going to shape the jury's view on how they looked at the more recent incident.
Sure.
And it was powerful, powerful evidence.
Yeah, and so in powerful evidence, I remember looking at the Draca video thinking, well, you know, he probably, his use of force was probably a little excessive and probably a little soon, but I'm always, and as conservative as I tend to be on judging these cases, that's not me in that position, right? No one can know what it feels like to be attacked by somebody and in that life or death situation than that person. So I always try to, especially from this criminal defense point of view, really give them the benefit of the doubt. And Drake kind of had me on the fence there. But then I find out this is some of the evidence that came out since we talked last, that he had had three documented prior incidences where he confronted people over handicap spots, including the very handicap spot at this convenience store that he shot McLaughlin over. And I'm quoting a CBS article that said that a black man who drove a septic truck, he told one of the detectives in this case that he parked that same handicapped spot 3 months before McLaughlin was shot, and that he said that Draco was there. He started yelling at him and threatened that he'd shoot him. And then even after this guy in the septic truck pulled away, Draco calls he's calling him racial slurs, by the way, on the way out, and McLaughlin was black. Drake calls the "How's my driving" number on the truck and tells this guy's boss that he was lucky that he didn't blow his employee's head off. The two other cases don't seem to be as inflammatory, but at least one of them he showed his gun. And so now all of a sudden I look at the video footage in a very different light.
The Williams rule of 404B type evidence can't be used just to show propensity or bad character and that sort of thing, but it is admissible if it sheds light on identity. We don't have that in this case. If there was a particular MO of a series of unsolved crimes, prior evidence might be admissible to help prove identity in a new charge. Likewise, motive is a proper use of this kind of evidence, absence of mistake to show that the acts were intentional. And I think in this instance, Mr. Draca has some big problems explaining why a prior confrontation in a handicapped parking spot that led to him believing that he could use deadly force, and somehow the guy that he was arguing with was lucky that he didn't. That's pretty powerful and pretty bad evidence for Draca. I'm on the fence because I just don't know enough about it, haven't seen the details of the reports to offer a guess as to whether it's coming in, but certainly if it does come in, that's going to create a separate battle for Draca's lawyers, and also it's going to, I think, shift the focus a little bit on Mr. Draca and what he really had in mind, and was he looking for a fight, and was he really fearful that McLaughlin was going to come at him and kick him or somehow do something to inflict that serious injury, or was he just angry and looking for a fight?
Sure. And under all of this, you know, we talk about this Williams rule or prior bad acts. I think part of what I'm hearing you say is that you're not justified in using deadly force to enforce handicap parking permits.
I think we can all agree to that.
That you can't shoot someone for parking in a handicap spot. Yeah.
I know you're being a bit of a smartass, but yes,
well, you know,
doesn't
do
it get it? It gets to the point where these little things, these little offenses or affronts get built and built, and pretty soon Draca became, I suppose, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt. He gets the benefit of the doubt legally, as he should, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt as to why he was doing that, because it's not against the law to point out to somebody that if they don't have a handicap parking sticker, they shouldn't be parking in a handicapped place.
Sure, and he noted enough that he has handicapped people in his family, and he takes it personally.
Yeah, and in this case, no doubt, McLaughlin very aggressively and forcefully shoved him and knocked him to the ground, and that was a criminal act right there that McLaughlin committed. But what followed immediately, though, is that 3 or 4 seconds of video that's going to determine Draca's fate for the next 5, 10, 15 years. You know, in Florida, manslaughter with a firearm is enhanced from 15 to 30 years. So Mr. Draca is facing 30 years in prison if he's convicted.
Yeah.
He's not likely to receive the whole amount, but the judge would have the authority to sentence him up to 30 years.
You know, and in the like 2 minutes or so that we have left, Donna, one other thing that came out in the press since we talked about this case is that Draca was evicted from his apartment. I think his landlord didn't want to renew the lease to a guy who's got this high-profile murder charge hanging over him. And he and his defense team tried to find someplace else to live in Pinellas County where this happened, and just couldn't. And by some setup, he found a place to live in Pasco County, and they had to go petition the judge for a change in his bond conditions so that he'd go live there. And for me, that illustrates just how upside down the whole world is for a defendant between the time that they're arrested and while they're waiting to go to trial. I mean, the whole universe is backwards.
I've had cases where clients were arrested for relatively low-level offenses that were dismissed or reduced to a fine and couldn't get an apartment because once they're in the system, they do the background checks that shows up as an arrest. The records are usually outdated, doesn't show that the charges were dropped or the person was acquitted, and I can't tell you how many letters I've written to prospective landlords, oftentimes on college campuses, trying to explain that there were no crimes committed here, that there were no charges filed or charges were dismissed, and sometimes successful, sometimes not. Mr. Draca has the spotlight of national news focused on him. His mugshot is everywhere. He's in the news as often as there's a court appearance or something strange happens in the case, and that will only continue. So he has all of that fallout to deal with in addition to facing the criminal charges. And certainly the fact that he can't get a place to live, it's probably the tip of the iceberg, but it certainly is representative.
It represents this whole litany of problems that he probably faces. And he's just in limbo. He's in limbo there. It's a nightmare. You've told me before that you wouldn't, that the prosecution itself, even if you're acquitted or at some point the charges are dropped, like in Joshua Walker's case that we talked about earlier, just the prosecution itself is a horrific punishment. And it's one that you might... this decision is a life or death decision when you defend yourself. We try to give lessons that reinforce the magnitude of that decision to the members of CCWSAFE. And beyond it being a life or death decision, even when you're justified, the whole world of crap that comes down upon you when you're involved, even in a justifiable self-defense homicide, is beyond description.
Every aspect of your life changes, and not for better. Financially, it's pretty hard for an employer to keep you on if you're facing a serious criminal offense, much less a high-profile criminal homicide of some sort. Stephen Maddox talks about the incredible emotional strain it put on him, of course, but people fail to appreciate the ripple effect on the family. You know, you have kids, you have a spouse, other mom and dad. Everybody is affected, maybe not to the extent you are when you wake up in the morning, but everybody wakes up wondering what life is going to bring when this case, you know, is finally resolved.
And Stephen Maddox, of course, is the CCWSAFE member that you helped defend, who was acquitted, but will talk candidly to us and to our members and to other folks about just what a hardship that long, 2-year prosecution was for him, even though he was found innocent of that charge, that it was a justifiable self-defense. Yeah. So that's that all underscores then what we say is, you know, tactically, you got to do what you got to do. Everyone who carries concealed has reconciled that in their mind. But what we always try to stress over and over again is if you can avoid that choice, then you should, not just for the sake of the life that gets saved, but for the nightmare that you might subject yourself to afterwards.
Yes, we know that at that critical moment, sometimes there's really nothing else that could have been done other than the decision to use the lethal force at that moment. As we look at these cases, we also have typically found places in the sequence where a little more level-headed thinking, or perhaps visualizing what may be coming if certain actions are taken, any number of steps toward de-escalation that would have helped avoid something that that even if it turns out to be a legally justified use of lethal force, legally justified, if there was any way leading up to it to see it coming and do something to simply avoid it, you have saved yourself a world of heartache and financial strain and, frankly, about 2 years of fear of the unknown.
Don, that sounds like a great way to wrap this up. You get the final word there. Really fun to talk with you about some fresh cases to get some new insights. Thank you for your time.
Enjoyed it as always, Sean. Thanks. Take care, and I'll look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Sooner than later. Thanks, Don.
You bet.